You go last, right, Larry?
Yeah.
Come here.
Don't forget it.
I'm Jeremy O'Cock.
Hi, Jeremy.
I was trying to think on the way over here, you know, when Larry and I first met. And I think it was probably at the Atlanta Roundup. Or, I'm sorry, the Atlanta Men's Workshop, The Rock. It was years ago, and we really didn't meet per se. I just became aware of who Larry was. And I knew he was doing a book study over at Mar. And I went and checked out a few times. And I really liked what I heard. And for a while, we shared the same sponsor. And somehow I just kept bumping into Larry here or there. We're not a glum lot somewhere. And we had a lot in common. And one of the things we had in common is we really didn't have great contact with our own sponsor, which was kind of interesting. And for lots of reasons, I started thinking, you know, I got more in common with Larry. And I think Larry can take me to a certain place better than this other person. So I thought about it for a long time and, you know, popped the question on Larry. And Larry said, I don't know, I'll have to think about it. And then later I find out that he doesn't even like me at all, and which you'll probably talk about shortly. But I got him back. I talked at Hell Place, and I told him what a dirty dog guy he was as a sponsor. But when I think of Larry, I think of what we learned here. We learned that really we're no better than anybody else. We're no worse than anybody else. We're just walking the same path together. And the difference between those that do and those that don't are the ones that actually do the steps. And I think of Larry. I see them do those daily. That I give you, Larry.
Well, the only thing that Jerry and I really have in common is we both stand up to pee. That's about where it ends. And it's true, I didn't like Jerry. God is very cute sometimes. He puts these cats in my life that I don't like. There's about half a dozen of them. And then I get to working with them, and we get into the grit, and all of a sudden you just fall in love with them. Because they're sicker than you, you know? It's an honor to be here. The last time I stood at this podium, a couple of things have changed. I don't know what it is with this room. Every time I come in here, the podium's in a different place. I'm expecting it to be down that hallway next time I come. But the last time I spoke, it was over there, and it was the day that we buried my oldest brother. Yeah. And, God, it's Christmas time. I want to thank this group. I mean, I've spoke here a number of times, and it's always an honor. I was telling Mary when we got here, this campus was my home group for 12 years, Mount Vernon's original group across the way here. And then I did a number of book studies for the old crotcheties on the back side of this building three or four times. And it's really funny when you do a book study with a bunch of people with 40 or 50 years. This is what you get. But it's cool, you know, because I'm still a student, and I like to be open to whatever is out there, because I don't know all there is to know about this book, and I absolutely love it. So thank you for having me. And my name is Larry Scott, and I am an alcoholic.
Hey, Larry.
And I'm free tonight. My sobriety date is December 31st, 1987. So if I make it for just a little bit longer, I'm going to have 28 years. Y'all right there doing this. Keep your shoes on, because it's more than 20. I can tell you this, I didn't get up this morning and cook my breakfast in a spoon and chase it down with red liquor. I did that for so long. I was reflecting with my friend Mary earlier tonight. The people, if we're awake and we pay attention to the people around us, we got it going on, because I've got this thing in me that wants me dead. And if I don't stay vigilant with it, it will kill me deader than fried chicken, because I see people on the periphery out here that are just falling out like flies. And I say this not to scare you, but it's a fact. We have a large group. Our home group is 250 people every Thursday night, and we bury 25 minimum a year out of that room. We're up to 24, and the holidays are still in front of us. And one of the guys, I bring this up because one of the guys we just buried was one of my sponsees. He drank a liver and a kidney up, and today's his birthday. It popped up on Facebook that he'd have been 46 today. We just buried him. So I'm grateful. I get caught up when I start thinking about people that stepped away before the miracle happened, because the miracle does happen. You can't. The sponsor that Jerry and I sponsored, that we shared, he always said, if you take the steps, you can't stop the promises from coming true. And there's not a problem on the face of the planet that the answer is not in here. They're all right here. And if you're new, believe me, it's in here. I know I called him one day and I said, I got this problem with my business. I got this guy that blah, blah. He says, the answer's in the book. I said, where? He says, it's in the book. And he hung up. So I immediately went to employers and it wasn't there. And I called him back and I said, it's not in there. He said, it is. Keep looking. Click. And I found it. And it was over into action, you know? But every answer is in here. It's right here. But you gotta be on top of it. Second thing I'll share with you is this recording by any chance it is. It's like a snake sitting there. The second thing I'll share with you is I'm not a treatment center guy, and I don't know what happens in treatment centers. I know that we get a lot of our fellowship from there, and I'm not a treatment center hater. I'm grateful for them because they're angels of mercy, and I'm glad they do what they do. So in order to get what our founders had, I have to study the manual they left behind. And I've become a real student of this book, and I learn a great deal every time I read it. One of the things that I discovered is they did the work rather rapidly. Not one of the first 100 took over 30 days to do all the work. The first three did it in days. And if you trace the recovery percentage rates and the success rates up until 1955, they were holding like 75% success rate. And then the inception of the treatment centers came along around 1972. And with the Hughes Act, and things started changing up a bit, but our recovery, our success rates have dropped a good bit, more than a good bit. They've dropped drastically. So, if I want to keep the things that I have today, and pass this on to the guys that I work with, I got to take them through this work in the manner that's laid out in the book and the time frames that our book gives us. And it's not my way. It's not the way I was brought up, because I spent the first 5 years of my life hanging out on the porch playing grab ass and smoking cigarettes, because that's what I did. This feels like a bottle of wine, Jerry. Thank you. Is there a cup?
I'll get you one.
Thank you so much. And I know that June 10th was the day that we call our Founders Day, and it was on that day that Dr. Bob took his last drink. Bill had had 5.5 months when he finally met Bob, and thank you so much. You didn't pee in us, did you?
A little bit.
Nothing like a little flavor.
I've played that game before, Larry. Don't worry.
Thank you for this. So, the point is when I'm working with guys and I employ the time frames that are in this book, it seems to go a lot better, because I get a guy started and I let him sit in this misery, he's gushing blood, and I put a Band-Aid on it. He's not going to stay. But if we the book talks about it talks about first aid over in the family afterwards. It says, I'm going to try and find this real quick because I want to read it to you. We just saw it last night. glaring pages, Jeff. Some sensitive people, what you think. We offer these people first aid. And I'm not going to bore. It's right in the back of the family afterward. First aid is if I've got a broken bone or a severed artery, and I go to the emergency room, they're not going to let me sit there. They're going to give me first aid. They're going to run triage on me, and they're going to get me fixed so that I can go home and begin recovering. And I will recover from that, and that's what our job is here, and I'll leave it at that. It's December 31st, 1987, and God intervened in my life. I had nothing to do with it. I had nowhere to go. I'm a homeless guy, which we're going to get into. And the last stop on the block was Alcoholics Anonymous. And it wasn't my first pick, I can assure you, but it was either that or die. And the man that 12-stepped me, which we're going to hear about in a second, is the man that we buried about a year ago. He saved my life. My first drink occurred in South Georgia when I was a little kid. I drank some moonshine out of a mason ball jar. Most horrible tasting crap I've ever put in my mouth. It burned all the way down to my toes. It stunk and burned. I swore I'd never touch that again. Little did I know I was going to chase that demon the rest of my life. I had no idea. And it was given to me by a cousin down there. And right after that, I get a little older. I grew up in Florida, Jacksonville, Florida. A little bit later, my family would send us to South Georgia to work in the tobacco fields during the summertime. And my job was to drive the tractors in the tobacco fields. And a love affair began during that era of my life. And the love affair was with the internal combustion engine, and the other one was with gasoline. I love everything about gas. I like the way it smells. I like the way engines sound when you rev them up because of it. But I like what it does to me. Because during the lunchtime hour, I would take those tractors out to this big 1,000-gallon tank, and it had a manual pump, and I'd fill these tractors up with gasoline. Well, I'm laying up on the hood of these tractors, listening for that gasoline to come up in the fill neck, and I'm getting loaded. And they would find me passed out by the tractors under these old pecan trees, grinning. And there were three tractors, so I got to get high three times a day. Well, at the end of the summer, I had to go back to Jacksonville, and I'm a pretty quick study. There's an Amoco station two blocks down the street, and I went and got a job there, pumping gas. And so, you know, it's like bartenders get it. You know, if you're a bartender, it's like you're the dope man. So they would find me passed out in the driveway of this gas station. I love gas. Shortly after that, somebody told me I could go and get some model airplane glue and squirt it into a penny candy sack and breathe it in and get high. Well, 27 of us went to jail one morning before school for huffing glue, and this was brand new. They didn't know what to charge us with. They just knew we were having way too damn much fun. They locked our little asses up, and they gave us 30 days probation, and I don't think there was ever a formal charge. I mean, we were laying up on the hood of these people's cars in this alleyway in Jacksonville, Florida, giggling and carrying on, you know. So I like to get loaded, and it didn't matter. I mean, I'm not real discriminating when it comes to what I put into my body. So life moves on, and I'm in probably my 20s, maybe my 30s, and I went to work for a rock and roll radio station in Jacksonville. And one of my clients was a big rock and roll club, and on the weekends they would have known bands there. You never know. Back in the day, you could go in there and it'd be Nazareth. Or back then, some of the guys from Molly Hatchet or Skinner or Allman Brothers would be in there on Friday and Saturday night. Well, on Wednesday night, this place was completely dead. And it was a gutted Winn-Dixie store. So it was big. And they needed to boost that income during the week. So they ran this promotion called Sink or Swim. I love Sink or Swim because you go in, you give them $15, they stamp your hand, and you go in and just drink all you can hold all night long. Well, by this point, I'm an alcoholic, and I would stop on the way and buy a pint of liquor and shoot it to get ready to go drink all I can drink. I love it when people laugh at that because I go to rooms and I say that, and everybody's just like, I'm thinking, where am I at the PTA? So, I mean, early on, I knew I had a problem. I mean, working in rock and roll radio, my disease loved it because there was a lot of stuff. You're talking the 70s, drugs, sex, and rock and roll, and there was a lot of it. And I want to say this about the booze, because there's some other things that I did. And when I came into the rooms, I came in through Cocaine Anonymous because that was my problem. I was sure of it because I was doing it every way that you could possibly do it. But once the smoke cleared, I looked at it and I went, ball jar of moonshine, first drug, bottles always on the table, with, no matter what I was doing, and the last drug was booze. So all these other things that I did were fortifiers. If I couldn't get there quick enough, I could take a little blue pill and, you know, kind of give it a little help. And if I got there too quick, I could put something in my nose or my vein or whatever and bring me back into the zone. So I'm an alcoholic, you know, and it didn't take me long to come and find really, really, really pure, solid guidance in Alcoholics Anonymous. And this is where I've been since 1989. Nothing wrong with the other fellowships. It's just this is home for me because I'm an alcoholic. A lot of my story doesn't have a lot to do with luck. You would think it would be. By the gravity of my comings and goings, because I should have died at my own hand by doing stupid things or been killed by the people I was running with, because they were not members of the Chamber of Commerce. I mean, these were bad people. So the most of my story from here forward is basically God's grace. You know, thank God I didn't get what I deserved. If you don't understand or have never looked up the word grace, it's undeserved favor or unmerited mercy. I'm living with this guy named Jimmy, and Jimmy owns a little bar, not much bigger than this room, over on the west side of Jacksonville. It's called Fling Nasty Saloon, and it's a biker bar. And psychedelic. Looks like Peter Max threw up all over the walls. I mean, just swirled psychedelic colors. And the floor was concrete, and it was so sticky from all the beer that had been spilled on it, you could hear every step you took, you know? And it had a pool table down at one end of it. And there had been so much beer spilled on that pool table, when you'd go to break the balls, you'd draw back and hit that cue ball, and it'd roll about that far and just lock up, because it was like trying to shoot pool in a bed of molasses, you know. And the weird phenomena of the thing about that bar, it was a biker bar, but it didn't take long for the hippies to figure out that the bikers liked what they were selling. So you had a mixture of hippies and bikers, and there was some bloodshed there because it was a violent. The bikers didn't want to pay for what the hippies had, so they just beat the hell out of them and take it. So anyway, I'm in there one night, and there was this guy standing at the bar that I'd never seen before, and he says to me, "Do you like to fly?" I'm drunk. He's drunk, and I said, "Yeah, it's a cold November night. Yeah, I love to fly." He said, "Well, I got a little airplane out here at Hurlong Field. Let's go for a ride." And I said, "Hot dog, let's go." I'm drunk. Don't know this guy. Don't know his name. Haven't seen him since that night. We get in his car and we start driving out Normandy Boulevard. About halfway there, I had that alcoholic moment of clarity. "Larry, you don't know this guy. I don't even know if this guy's got a damn driver's license, much less a pilot's ticket. But there's a part of me that you need to understand. There's a cowboy in here. I got on a big old Stetson hat and long hair and a 45 hog leg because that's who I think I am, you know. And the cowboy in here goes, shut up, we're going for an airplane ride. So we went on out there and we pull up. And when I tell you this is an airstrip, it's a stretch, guys. It's nothing but a grass field. There's no lights on. There's no tower. There's nobody there. There's a damn trailer house off about 50 yards in the distance. No lights on. And there's four or five little old single-engine planes lined up. He says, I'm going to go in and get the key. I'll be back in a minute. I'll leave the motor running because it's cold. And I said, I thank you for that. Well, he got out of the car and left me in there with this. And this is getting sober by this point. You remember Bill said he fear sobered me for a bit? He goes in there and this, I said, you know, I just got to tell this guy that I've had a change of heart. I don't think this is a good idea. So he comes out and he waves and I waves and he jumps in a plane. Light comes on. Nothing else happens. He got out. He went back in the trailer house. He got another set of keys. Came back out. Got in another plane. He waved. I waved. Light came on in that plane and nothing else happened. He got out of that plane, and I'm a pretty quick study. We're stealing a damn airplane. And I don't even know if this guy's got a pilot's license. He's drunk, and so am I. And we weren't doing just alcohol, right? So he gets in that third plane, light comes on, and it backfired. A little smoke belched out of it, and he does this. And I said, this is it. This is when you get, just go up there and just say, no, I don't think I'm going to go. Because he can't take you if you don't get in the plane. He's not going to kill you. The cowboy says, get in the damn plane and shut up. So I get in. And I get all cinched up, and he hands me a headset. And grass runway, so it's bouncing around. And he goes, where do you want to go? And I said, dude, you're driving. I don't care where we go. It's freaking cold, it's dark, and you're a thief, you're a plane. So we get it, and so he takes off, and we start heading due east, and he gets the bar on that headset somehow or another, fling nasties, and he says, we're going to buzz the bar. So as the crow flies, we're in the air maybe 10 minutes, he starts dropping altitude, and he starts banking, and I'm looking out his window. And there are the power lines right there. And there's all the hippies and bikers on the sidewalk doing it. And we came down and just about clipped the wires. And my ass at that point had bit a hole completely into the seat of the cushion of that seat. And there was no more talking after that. There was not a word, hey, how you doing? How's it going? What do you think? I got lockjaw. He kept flying east, and he only pulled up a little bit. We were just over the treetops. Is there anybody in here from Jacksonville? There usually is when I tell this. There's a bridge over there called the Temecula Bridge, and it crosses over the Ortega River. Well, this bridge, instead of having a square opening, has got one of these half-moon-shaped openings. And it's really important to know that Jacksonville, Florida, the waterways are governed by the tides. I didn't look at the tides that morning because I didn't care. I wasn't going fishing. And all of a sudden, he gets right down over the top of that river. I mean, it's right there. And we're headed to this bridge. Did I mention that we're in an airplane? We are hauling ass. And I looked at that bridge. And I looked out each side at those wings. And I'm a pretty quick study. We're going to need some Vaseline to get through that opening. And by God, he buzzed that bridge. Not over it, under it. I was in Canada, and this one woman says, how long were you in the hospital? I said, seriously. So, you know, God didn't want me dead. I don't like flying. I just don't. I do a lot of it, and I don't like it. We Well, working in this radio station, the Lynyrd Skynyrd Band, they were from that west side of town where our transmitter site was, and they would come in there pretty frequently, and they'd come in for autograph signings and interviews and this and that. They came to the transmitter site mainly to get loaded, because that's what you could do out there, because it was a big antenna and a little block building in the middle of a field. But I got to be friends with those guys, and I ended up moving in with Leon, the bass player. And I left the radio station, and I went to work for their management company, an outfit out of New York called Sir Productions. And life on the road with that band was probably the most insane period of my life. I've done a lot of crazy things, but there was some fun there, but it was insane. And you could get by with things because of who they were that you couldn't get by as a normal civilian. But the violence is the part that really screwed me up. I mean, it was getting really, really violent by 1977. And mid-77, I started contacting MCA Records to ask them if I could cross over from being on the road with the band to doing something with the label and just getting away from these guys. They were my friends. We fished together. We had fun, but you give them some dope and some booze, and it got violent. I mean, we were in New York City one night playing three nights at the Beacon, and Ronnie slammed a steel hotel door on Gary Rossington's fret fingers. Broke these three fingers right here. Thank God there was a lot of other bands in town at the time, and we had a lot of people that could fill in. But anyway, the violence was just over the top. I'm not a violent guy. I'm crazy. I've done some nutty things, but I'm not violent. So they said, yeah, we'll see you. And October the 19th of 1977, I met with an MCA record company executive in the parking lot of a shopping center in Greenville, South Carolina. They were doing an autograph signing, and we were talking about the transition. And as usual, the conversation didn't go my way. I told them to go screw us off, and I wasn't getting on the plane. And not only did I not get on the plane, some of the other crew members and some of the backup people didn't get on that plane because it had already started spitting flames and engine failures and you name it. The plane should have been retired 10 years before it went down. End of that story. So a buddy of mine came to Greenville, got me, went back to Jacksonville, and later that night on October the 20th, we found out that the Freebird had fallen into the swamps in Macomb, Mississippi. And I'm still a madman, and I'm thinking, boy, what a coincidence. What a lucky break that was. But see, I get with you, and you teach me that that's not what happened. That's probably the finest form of God's grace that I can talk about. I wasn't supposed to be on that plane. I'm supposed to be here with you tonight. This is what he laid out for me to do. I don't choose the podium. And sitting behind the table with Gene Russell, I got a dog I like to pet and a motorcycle I like to ride, but I'm all over the world with Gene and doing this. But this is what God wants me to do, because anyway, I don't like flying. Gene and I are flying to Grand Prairie, Alberta last year, and we're in a big aircraft, and I'm sitting there with my computer playing, and they had these TV screens. Gene is, if you don't know Gene, yeah. Gene is an asshole. He is. He's an ass. So they got these TV screens on the back of the seats. And I'm sitting there playing on my computer, you know, doing whatever I was doing. And Gene goes, hey, Larry, look at this. And I look up. He's watching Air Disasters. And there's a tail of a 757 sticking out of the ground. And I said, Gene, you're such a dick. So the group recently, my home group, gives me a copy of Snakes on a Plane. Because I hate snakes. I don't hate snakes. I just don't want to be around them. So, fast forward, it's 1980. I burned my life to the ground in Jacksonville. I'm homeless. My brother that lives here called me and said, you need to come to Atlanta. It's the land of milk and honey. I came here, went to work for another record company that I'd done some things for. I'm unemployable. If I'm not drinking or drugging, I'm good. I can, man, I'm a great employee. But I can't not drink and I can't not drug. So they fired me. And I'm interviewing and I'm getting great jobs, but I just can't hang on to them. And fast forward, it's 1987, and a gal that I'd been in and out of relationships with for 10 years came home from work. She worked at that record company, and she walked in the door and she said, "You're dying, and you can't do that here. You've got to go." Well, y'all know how I reacted to that. I mean, it's September of 87. And I said some pretty horrible things, and I walked out the door. And I got no place to go. I don't have friends. I'm a dope fiend. I'm. You go back over around page 8 in Bill's story, it says I was 40 pounds underweight. He could eat little or nothing when drinking, which was all the time. Bill was dying. I was dying. I was skin and bones. I bet I weighed 130 pounds soaking wet. So I'm sleeping in abandoned cars and under bridges and in the bush. And every now and then I'd get an occasional mercy bed or day bed where they would say, "You can come and stay here tonight, but when we get up to go and go to work tomorrow, you got to be gone." And I'd go, "Okay." And that was very, very random. And somebody had introduced me to this lady who had two teenage children in Lawrenceville or Duluth, and I had spent the night on her couch. And about 10 o'clock the next morning, at this point I'm not doing anything but drinking, because I don't think drinking's my problem. But I'm detoxing, and I didn't know that. So when I would get up out of bed, you could slap the sheets and water would splatter. I was detoxing that hard. I thought I had AIDS, because night sweats is one of the big deals. So anyway, her phone rang. I don't know that. I can't even tell you this woman's name today. I wouldn't recognize her if she walked in the door. Her phone rang. And she says, "Larry, it's for you." Nobody knew I was there. It was my brother. Otter God. And he said, "I understand you're in bad shape." I said, "No, I'm good." "I got this." He says, "You better get some help or we're going to bury you." And he kept talking. And I didn't know that he had found you already, because he was my running buddy. He had the money and I had all connections and perfect pair. He kept talking, and his message had depth and weight. I didn't know that's what it was at the time. And he says, "I'm going to give you a phone number, and I suggest you call it." And I said, "You don't understand. I'm homeless. I can't afford Charter Petford." You know, there's commercials on there that go, "If you don't get help at Petford, get help somewhere." And I want to throw a shoe through the TV. He says, "It's not. It won't cost you anything. Just call this number." And I called. It was a hotline, and you guys met me, and I went in, and I summed you up real quick. I walked in. You were all sitting in chairs in a line. There was a guy standing behind a podium like a preacher. You opened up with a prayer, and then he preached a little bit. This was my perception of my first meeting. And then they had an altar call. And you came up and they gave you these things here, these poker chips. And they told me that if my ass was kicked and I wanted to surrender, this was the one. So I came out from behind the pole in the back of the room, because you know that's where we sit. I came up and I got that. And then y'all passed the hat. I said, "Yeah, I've landed in another Baptist church." And then y'all circled up and prayed again, and I was convinced. So the thing I knew to do to quiet that down was to go down to the cheap liquor store and get two bottles of whatever the cheapest champagne they had, because I needed to celebrate this white chip, and I did. And I continued to drink from September until December, trying to convince y'all that your way was wrong. And y'all looked at me like I was nuts and said, "Keep coming back, Larry." So I've got another mercy bed. It's December 31st, 1987. Another woman with two teenage children in Lawrenceville, right off Johnson Road. And I got up that morning and I started drinking. And what I share with you at this point is pretty much hearsay because I drank all day long. I was drinking, I think, gin. And she was in the kitchen, had about a four-gallon pot of collard greens and the black-eyed peas for New Year's Day. And she was over in the sink cutting up these collards, and I took that big four-gallon rolling, boiling pot of pork and greens, and I poured it on her arms. And then I took off my belt with that big Western belt buckle and wrapped it around my hand, and I went through her home. Now, this is a mercy bed. And I destroyed her belongings, her TV, her electronics, lamps, you name it. So the progressive nature of this disease had caught me, and that was it. I woke up January 1st, 1988, and I love college football, but I can't tell you who played, who won, can't tell you much about it. The book describes it very well. It talks about the horror and remorse. The next morning, it was on me, and I just wanted to die. And what happened is a couple of y'all showed up, and you threw me in your car, and you took me to one of your A&A meetings. I picked up that second white chip. And at this point, I'm no longer trying to convince you that an occasional beer is okay, because I don't know how to do an occasional beer. My old partner, Charlie Yao, described that condition pretty clear. He said that I was no longer desperate. I'd become hopeless. Because, you see, desperate has some wiggle room to it. Desperate means if I hold my mouth just right, she'll let me back in the big bed. If I say just the right thing, my old buddy will let me back on that job site. And that attorney I got in my back pocket might just get me one more NOLO. That's desperate. I was hopeless, which means you're going to die graveyard dead. And if you read Bill's story, he talks about going to the hospital in desperation, and then he starts using the word hopeless, and that's when he completely surrendered. And I was hopeless. I was willing to do whatever you told me to do. Don Henley says in one of his songs, I was willing to crawl through broken glass on my lips. Whatever you needed me to do, I would do it, because I was dying. I start going to these discussion meetings with these old-timers out in Vinings, where my brother went. And average sobriety in there was about 35 years. And those old-timers loved me because they didn't get a lot of new people in there. But see, my perception of them is they were the meanest creatures on the planet. They said things to me that just didn't make any sense, and it felt like they were always, you know, stabbing me. So you told me I needed to come early and stay late. My brother-in-law had given me a job right around the corner here at Perimeter Ford, selling cars. Hated it. Don't recommend it, but it was a job. And I'm working over there on a draw versus commission, and I can't sell anything because I'm detoxing hard. I would bend over like this to show somebody the bottom side of a car or something, and the water would just pour out of my nose like it was it was awful. So I can't sell anything, and I'm into these people for $500 for working there, paying them to work there, which is a weird concept to me. I walked into the meeting early to help set up the chairs, put out the ashtray, and there's this guy, Bob Canatt, there. Bob's like an old, he sounds like an old Baptist preacher, and I'd walk in, and I'd say, hey, Bob. Hey, Larry, how you doing, buddy? I said, well, I'm not doing good, buddy. I'm working at this Ford store, and those sons of bitches, $500 for working there, and sales managers are talking down to me and treat me like dirt. Bob said, yeah, you right on schedule. He said, you're exactly where you're supposed to be. And I'm thinking, Bob, you're hard of hearing. So I helped him set up, and, you know, then after the meeting, I had to hang around and put chairs away and wash ashtrays and blah, blah, blah. We're sitting in this this little discussion meeting one night, and it had gone around. Don't know what they were talking about, and I wasn't going to say anything because I was not having a good day. And this guy, Jack Blaylock, says to me, he said, Larry, how's it going with you? And I got about 45 days or something, and I said, well, today started off kind of rough. About 10 o'clock, my whole life was in the ditch, flames all around me. And I remembered a little tool that you told me I could use that I could just start my day over, that I could just turn it over. So I went in the bathroom, pulled down some paper towel, got on my knees, grabbed the sink, and I just turned it over. And it's been a good day ever since. He's sitting over there smoking these unfiltered Luckies, and he's smoking them down like to a roach, you know. And he said, "Yeah, buddy." He said, "Turning it over is some good stuff." He said, "Back when I was in Alabama, I used to write them bad checks. And I turned them over to God. God turned them over to the sheriff, and he came and locked my ass up." And, you know, I'm thinking, there's no talking to these people. There was an old biker out there. I'm going to try and tell this thing because I've really never shared it from the podium. It's about my spiritual experience. A guy named Billy Fisher, he was very proud of his wounds. He was a biker. He'd lift his shirt and show you the gunshot wounds and the knife wounds, and he always packing a nickel 32. Anyway, I went up to Billy because I could hook up with this guy, and I said, "I had been listening to you, and I knew that the secret was right in the fourth step. Now, I've not done one, two, or three, right? But if I could get that fourth step out of the way, I was good." So I went up to Billy and I said, "Billy, I said, would you help me out with this fourth step?" And he says, "Do you have a book?" I said, "I do, but it's at home." He went over and got one of the books and he opened it up and he says, "Have you read any of the book?" And I lied. Imagine that. And he says, "Have you seen this?" And he opened the page 60. And I said, "I'm sure I have." He said, "Do this. Go home tonight. You read 60 through 63. And you call me tomorrow and we'll get on that fourth step." So I get home and I open up that book, that old ugly blue book my brother had given me. When I opened it, it went. And I laid here in the bed, and I'm staying at my sister's house, and I started reading. And all of a sudden, I could feel the moisture just flowing off my face because they had written a book about me. I'm that actor. I'm trying to arrange everything to suit me. Even back to asking Billy to get me through this fourth step. I'm the tail wagging the dog. I didn't call Billy the next day. I just was appalled. And next Tuesday, I went over to the meeting. He says, "Well, I didn't hear from you. Did you read those pages?" I said, "I did." So, needless to say, I had read that third step prayer. And I'm still homeless. I end up on a futon off of Georgia 400 with this gal that I used to use with. She knew my reputation, and she said, "You can stay here for the night, but you got to go in the morning." And this futon that she had allowed me to sleep on was her animal's bed. And I took off my shirt, and I laid down on that bed, and the hair and the grit, the dirt from those animals and the smell of animal urine. And all of a sudden, it hit me, and I went, this is what it's come to. And I remembered in that book, it said that the wording was optional so long as I expressed the idea. And I rolled off that bed. I got on my knees because that's what you told me I needed to do. And I said that third step prayer to the best of my ability. The next night, I was heading up I-85. And this was my spiritual experience. It wasn't a flash of light. It wasn't a voice. It wasn't a burning bush. It was a knowledge, and it was just as real as looking at you right now. And that knowledge was that I never, ever, ever had to be alone again. And it's held true to this day. I can get up against it, it being life, and I'm not alone in that. Not only am I surrounded by you, but if I'm by myself, God's always with me, and he's right there. All I got to do is just ask, and he's right there. That's my experience. I can tell you I started seeking in 1972 after a tragic motorcycle accident, and I stuck my head in the Catholic Church. I stuck my head in the Episcopal Church. I stuck my head in metaphysical science, Hindu philosophy. I took a look over it, and I hung out a long time over at Unity because the Unity Church felt a lot like this. And then I found what my true yearning was for, and that was my heritage, which is Native American, and that's where I live today. So my friend Mary is she was talking, she did a talk the other night out in Woodstock, and she said, "God is, I don't understand him." And I hung on to a belief in a power greater than myself, but I didn't understand what that was. And I'm still not real clear that I do today. Because if I start saying I understand God, I put him in a box and I put limitations on him. That's for me. And I'll get off that tirade. But I can tell you, since I've been here, I've done this work and I've taken commitments to do whatever, no matter what I thought of them, without prejudging. I've come out of this lethargy. I'm no longer asleep. I'm aware. And when things happen, I don't go, "Wow, what a coincidence that was." And I love what my old sponsor used to say. I'd get my ass in a jam and he'd say, "Gonna be interesting to see what God does with this one." You know? But when the awareness begins and you start seeing these things going on around you, you can't point the finger at anybody but God. It's all God. It's all God. It's all God. And, you know, there are things that happen that I got nothing to do with. And it's all God. And if you've been around here a while, you're understanding what I'm talking about. If you're new, don't leave, because it happens. All of a sudden you go, "Wow." I came in here really late in life, and I had almost a year before I ever saw my very first dogwood blossom. Grew up around them. Walked out my front yard waiting on a ride to a meeting one day, and there's this tree full of white flowers, and I went, "What the hell is that?" So one morning I got up to do my... I was going somewhere, waiting on a ride to go hear Dr. Paul Olliger. He was speaking at Ridgeview. And I got up that morning, I got on my knees, which still was weird because I was raised Baptist, and being on my knees is just kind of weird, but got on my knees, and I, you know, and my prayer felt as though it was a canned speech. It was all from my lips. It had no meaning. Words. And so what, you know, I'm growing this little baby conscience, and I didn't feel very good. So I called that old mean sponsor up. And I said, and he's not there. And it's a Saturday morning. And I kept calling, and I kept calling. And I had that accordion phone list. It was a magnetic, had like 200 names on it. And I went down it, and I couldn't get anybody. And I finally got this old lady from the home group, Jean Graves, arm cut off at the shoulder, had more money than God, and filthy rich. She always wore hair up in a bun. She was about 100 years old, had about 200 years sober, had dangly jewelry, and everybody was dolling. And she loved her some Larry. "Hello?" I said, "Jean, it's Larry Scott." "Hey, darling." I said, "Jean, I got this problem." She said, "Tell me about it, baby." I said, "Jean, I got up this morning and got on my knees and said my prayers, and they were empty. Everything just came from my lips and not from my heart. Had no meaning, no feeling. It weren't sincere. And I don't feel very good about it." There's this long, pregnant pause. She comes back and says, "Well, darling, pray about it." Old bastards. So I hook up with this other sponsor. And he did something for me that I wouldn't have done for myself. And what he did is he introduced me to the men in AA. I'm no longer hanging out on the porch playing grab ass. The men in AA came into my life. And the very first Atlanta Men's Workshop I went to, I didn't want to go. And my sponsor said, "It's 400 guys in the woods for 3 days at a 4-H camp." And I'm thinking, I just don't think that's me. He said, "Well, I suggest you go or find another sponsor." I said, "What did you tell me those dates were?" So I go down there, and on Friday and Saturday night, there's a spiritual bonfire out there. It's kind of like a little circle, and there's some rocks or whatever, and they got this fire. And during that meeting, the voices are dropped a little lower, and the subjects are a little more secretive, and there's some tears. And I don't want to be there. So they got these big loblolly pines, right? I'm standing behind this pine tree. It's dark. and the spiritual bonfire is over there, and I'm looking around this pine tree, hiding. About that time, I hear a stick broke, and I look over, and there's a guy over there hiding behind another pine tree. Hot dog, I'm not unique. So Bill taught me to trust the men. And if you're new and you're just beginning this walk, if you haven't taken that stride yet, get ready, because they know you. You can't run none of them games. It's over. The buck stops right here. And the other thing he taught me is respect for women, because I didn't have that. Today I love the sisters that I have in my life because they trust me, and they can trust me. And I've learned that they have the same right to recovery and to get sober as I had. And it's up to me to help them to get sober as best I can. And most of the time, the best way I can do that is just leave them alone until their sponsor gets them through the work. And our home group was founded by women, and it's grounded by women. We've got probably over 50% females. And if you come to our meeting on Thursday night and you want a decent seat, come early, because they come and they put their shawls and purses and car keys and big book on about the first five rows. And we don't put up with anybody screwing with our new people, men or women. It's just, you know, this is not the club. This is a place that we come to get our lives changed and to get introduced to a power greater than ourselves. And that's what this man taught me, is respect for females, and taught me respect for the newcomer and how to guide them gently. And then after a period of time, I changed after 17 years and went to another guy. And this guy taught me a great deal. He taught me the next level of building a reputation. That when you call me and you ask me to do something, either I do it, and if I don't show up, you'll read about it, because I get killed on the way. It's called commitment, and by holding a commitment, you build a reputation. And when you do that, you're working on this little thing called integrity. And there are two things in my life that aren't up for grabs today. I got a really good life. I got a life that it blows my mind. But the two things that aren't up for grabs is my reputation and my integrity. And if you do this work and you live this way of life, not just between the Serenity Prayer and the Lord's Prayer, but between the Lord's Prayer and the Serenity Prayer, that's where the work is done. The hardest place in the world for you to do this is out there. We can love each other and be all cuddly up in here. Walk out that door. That's where reality is. And I've just followed the guidance of those guys. And kind of wrap this thing up. In the early 90s, I went to a meeting for social reasons only. A lot of guys and gals were there that I got sober with. Turned out from that night, I got turned on to the Joe and Charlie style big book study. And some guys gave us 6 months of their life. I say us, me and my sponsor family, three tiers down. We all, every Tuesday night, we would do this big book study, and they taught us from the blank page all the way through Dr. Bob's Nightmare, every word in that book. We had period correct dictionaries, and they taught it. And at the end of the 6 months, I said, guys, thank you so much for the sacrifice and the information. It's rocking. And they said, dude, that's not the way this ends. It's on Tuesday night. And I said, what do you mean? He says, you got to carry this message out to others. And I said, yeah, I'll get around to that. 2 days later, Thursday, my phone rings, and it was Rob Hayes, one of the guys. And he said, I've been carrying this message over at the Triangle Club for a good while now, and I can't be there tonight. You need to do it. We're on this page, this paragraph, click. And I went. I'd never done a book study. I'd sit in them. And these aren't discussion meetings. This is the Bill saw his practice in teaching. And this is basically teaching the literature. And so didn't go badly. And that was on a Thursday. On Monday, the director of the Mar outfit over here, Doug Brush, called me and he said, "You guys have finished the book over here." I said, "Yeah." He said, "How would you feel about coming back over here and carrying this to our men's clients?" And I said, "Okay." And we were there for 10 years. And we've been over here at this location for 10 years now. The book means a lot to me. And through all this, Joe McQuaney died, and then Charlie got sick, and we got invited to carry this message on the road. And Charlie Parmalee became my mentor, and he guided me through that snake pit of how do you go to Iceland and Canada and do these things. And they're all a little different, and it's not what I would have chosen. I don't tell you this to impress you, because as my friend can testify, traveling, doing 12-step work is not always glamorous, and it's not always convenient. We just do it. But I would call Charlie up and I'd say, "Charlie, I'm doing, you know, I've lost my partner. I had a partner, Christian Proctor, and Christian's life changed, and I needed to get somebody else to travel with me and to sit with me on Thursday night." And I called Charlie out in Arkansas and I said, "I don't know what to do." I said, "We're booked out for 2 years here and I don't have a partner." And Charlie Parmalee was an old chicken farmer from Arkansas. He said, "Well, Larry, you're going to need to adjust." And I said, "Could you elaborate on that a little bit?" So anyway, it's a blessing to be able to go out and meet the people that we do and that we get to do these things with. We're booked out all the way through next year, and I've got friends all over the world now and a network. Like I said in the beginning of this talk, I'm never alone. I'm always surrounded by you. And if you're not in my face or on my phone, you're on my computer. And I wouldn't trade this life for anything. If you're new and just starting this thing, and I don't know what you hear at other meetings, but I would plead with you and beg of you to pay attention to what the book says. It says we've recovered and been given the power to help others. We can help when ministers and doctors can't. We can help when psychiatrists fail. But we do that by showing the new person the solution. There's only one. It's in that book. And don't magpie the crap that we hear in a lot of rooms all over the world, not just in Atlanta, about just don't drink and go to meetings. If I could just not drink and go to meetings, I wouldn't be up here in front of this church tonight. I'd be at home wiping down my bike and playing with my dog. But I can't. I got to bring this here to be with you. Because the viewpoint that I've got from up here, you guys are looking at the backs of each other's heads. Up here, you get to see the light come on. You didn't get sick overnight. You ain't going to get well overnight. That's another good one. Going to these meetings, we tell a lot of war stories. I learned this one early on down here at 8111. Back in the day, back before that was Halfway House Heaven, there were a lot of women from Sandy Springs and Dunwoody going there that had a lot of money, and they're drinking scotch out of coffee cups. You know, they're not, they're alcoholics, but they're not dumpster divers like I was. They didn't live in the bush. So for me to go in there and share those stupid war stories of where I came from, they're going, "Wait a minute, I'm in the wrong place. I didn't do that. I never slept in a dumpster. I never slept in the bush." Carry a vision. This does work. This does work. And it's right here in our book. Our purpose as we lead discussions and speak from podiums and work with newcomers one-on-one, our job is this. Is to comfort the disturbed and to disturb the comfortable. So if anything I've said up here tonight made you wiggle a little bit, you might want to think about what you're doing or not doing within the rooms of AA. Are you doing enough? Are you carrying this message or are you carrying the mess? My sponsor is Chris Raymer, and I was talking with him last night. And I get disgusted because we take a lot of shots because we don't follow that norm about just don't drink and go to meetings. It's out of the book. And you got to stand up and grow a set every now and then and talk about what the truth is, because we're burying people here. This is life or death. This ain't fun or games or a cool beer down at the Quick Trip. This is the thing that's killing people. And in 1942, I think it was, 1942, Bill said, our chief responsibility to the newcomer is an adequate presentation of the program. That's what my job is. My goal until the day that y'all bury me is to bring this program back into the fellowship like it was in its early days. Never going to be like it was in 55. Those days are gone. But we can affect a change in our circle. Come to Thursday night and take a look. They're not coming up there to hear a couple of monkeys read out of a book, I promise you. People are getting well. And it ain't because of us. I never went to the bartender, to the bar for the bartender. I went for what he was pouring. And we're pouring the truth up there. Jerry Sinatra over there on Monday nights, he's pouring the truth over there. Jerry's in the trench. Still don't like him much, but the boy is he's a horse. He's a real mule. And in closing, I'm going to leave you with a little challenge here. Go to your group. You got a regular group. Go in, get your coffee, and then go get your chair because you got your chair. Everybody's got their chair. Do you sit there every Friday night?
Yeah, because I go to the bathroom.
Yeah. I'm impressed you've been sitting there all night.
I pooped a little bit while you were talking.
Oh, my God.
Inner chair.
That's a vision for you. Go to your room, go to your meeting, get your coffee, go to your chair. Don't sit in the chair Amy sits in because it may have a little mess in it. But go to your chair and sit down. And whether you've got a discussion meeting, you've got a book meeting, you've got a speaker meeting, whatever it is, it doesn't matter. Go to your chair, get your coffee, sit down and close your eyes for 1 hour. And listen in your meeting for that 1 hour. And see if you can hear the solution in your group. If there's a newcomer in your meeting, can he hear the solution to what's killing him? I think you're going to be appalled. And if you do that and you get the same response that I normally get, you will affect some change. And I'm not sitting here telling you I walk on water because I don't. But the change has got to begin somewhere, and it can begin with you. You know, I was just over in Dothan, Alabama, and I mentioned this, and they said, you can't do a book study in this town. Nobody will come. Well, do one and see if they don't. There's two types of people in our rooms, this room right here and every room we go to. You got players. The players are the guys that unlock the door, set up the chairs, make the coffee, put out the podium, the chips. They chair the meetings. You got the people that greet at the door. They give the rides. They buy the books for the newcomer. Then you got the fans. They come and sit in the chairs. They put their nasty feet on the chairs in front of them. They steal the books. They take the coffee. They leave early and come late. So my question to you is, what are you going to be? You going to be a player or a fan? I'm already over. I could go a little bit longer, but I'm not going to. Help, we need you. We need every one of you. We need your humor. We need your intellect. We need you to carry this message in your own special way. Over in chapter 7, you know, in the 12th step, it says, you'll see how your ninth step promises. You'll see how your experience will benefit others. I meet so many Larry Scotts. Some of them are even named Sinatra. We need you. Thanks for being with me for this hour.